Judge Fischer is commenting on the fact that I haven't moved to the 21st century totally and eschewed paper. So my wife tells me I need to do that. And, of course, I'm going to listen to both Judge Fischer and my wife.
Please listen to your wife.
Well, welcome to One and All. We have some important cases today for the court's consideration, and we have a lot of counsel who are going to be speaking today. We welcome all of you, and I am not going to be keeping track of who's jumping up for 2 minutes or 4 minutes or whatever. However, she will, and we will be looking for the lights. I think on some of the shorter presentations, it might behoove you not to ask for rebuttal, because 30 seconds of rebuttal might not make sense. So you guys said you were going to decide on who's going to do rebuttal. What are you going to do, Mr. Goldberg?
So in our request, we asked to collectively agree rebuttal, and that the time, that rebuttal time not be taken out of any of those separate requests. We set aside 3 minutes of the total time.
And have you decided who among counsel will do that, or is that to be... On that issue.
That's all right. No.
Oh, you mean you'll wait to hear what
yes.
he says?
Yes.
Well, he's going to be saying a lot. Mr. Zalzberg never disappoints on that particular score. I mean, in a good way. All right. So let's begin then. Who shall be the first? And lest we begin without everyone being introduced, our wonderful colleague Judge Nygaard is on the phone. I believe you can see him.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Judge Nygaard.
Good morning. I am going to be having my microphone on mute for most of the time because I understand there's an echo or feedback problem. But everything's fine here. I can see and I can hear you.
Actually, there's no problem. Whenever you want to chime in, please do. Wonderful to see you and hear from you.
Thank you.
All right, counsel, go ahead, sir.
My name is Mark Cedrone. May it please the court. I represent Appellant Alfano in these consolidated appeals, and I'm going to be addressing the facial efficacy of the mail fraud charges. As the court knows, mail and wire fraud
Maybe you want to just put your speaking to the
microphone. Oh, I'm sorry. I generally thought I spoke loud enough, but we'll let it go.
This one time, not so.
Okay.
speak loud enough to hear and hear
it.
Understood.
It's a long way to hear it.
It's a long way.
And the narrow question for consideration here, sir, is whether the indictment sufficiently alleged a property interest that could be deprived as a result of the alleged scheme to defraud. And more narrowly, the issue could be framed as, you know, whether the city and state had a property interest in fines and costs in unadjudicated traffic citations, when it's clear from the pleading and from the governing law that the Pennsylvania system for traffic regulation is largely regulatory. The ticket holders are presumed not guilty throughout the entire process.
Well, let me ask you the question about the property right. At some point in the continuum, there is a property right, and your point is it's not until the point of adjudication, I presume.
It could not be until at least the point of adjudication at the earliest. Yes, sir.
So let me ask you this question. Assume this scenario. I want consideration. I go to my lawyer and say, you know, I did it. Whatever it is, I was speeding. I was whatever. But I can't have this on my record. I'm a whatever public official, or I'm a judge, or whatever. Please take care of it. That lawyer calls a personal talks to a judge, need consideration, whatever. Now, I know when I talk to my lawyer that I was guilty, right? There's no doubt in my mind. But I'm asking for the system to work in my favor, right? Because at least hypothetically, I want it to go down the chain, and I want consideration so that it's taken care of. In that scenario, does the state or Commonwealth have a property right to the fine that would come about?
Well, Your Honor, we're here today to look at the allegations alleged. One of the key problems in this case is that there is not a single allegation of, in fact, guilt. The hypothetical that Your Honor posits is really very simple, that if such facts were included in the indictment, then there would be at least an allegation of, in fact, guilt. I'm not entirely certain, sir, that even under that scenario, until there's an adjudication, that there would be a vested property interest. And here is why. Even if you are the defendant in this case and you are, in fact, guilty, and you tell your lawyer you're in fact guilty, and you then ask that the process be manipulated because for whatever reason you wish to avoid the consequence. In this case, the government alleged the consequence is some future fine. You wish to avoid that consequence of being guilty. The statute provides the traffic court judges with discretion to make a decision any way they want. It doesn't have to be because of the consideration. They're not obliged, for example, to find somebody guilty just because the traffic ticket was issued guilty. They could qualify.
But in the scenario that I've given you, I would presume they would be obligated because I'm telling my person I did it.
But there's still as a constitutional requirement that the government prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
For instance, what normally happens, one of the things that may happen is the officer who gave the ticket doesn't show up for court, and they couldn't prove their case.
That's right. That's exactly
right.
I'm sorry, sir?
Is that one of the ways in which a judge in traffic court would be able to find a person? Even though he had told his attorney, as Judge Greenway said, I really did it, I just don't want the points.
Yes, sir. And until there's that guilty adjudication, the city and the state don't have any right of entitlement to the fines and costs.
Let me ask you another question here. I know that the property or money question is money or property question is key to your argument. But it seems to me when you look at both the Mail and Marfa statutes, notwithstanding McNally and the McNally decision, which we obviously have to follow, but there is some significance in this case, at least, to devising any scheme. Because this, to me, looks awfully close to at least a scheme. Would you acknowledge that there was a scheme that existed in traffic court?
Yes, sir. I would acknowledge that, at least as a matter of pleading, the government has pled a scheme. But the operative question here is whether the scheme was to deprive property as defined under Cleveland and Pasquantino and McNally and so forth.
All right. What about, let me ask you about a traffic ticket.
Yes, sir.
And, a traffic ticket under the Pennsylvania rules is really a citation, I believe.
Yes, sir.
It's properly called. But is a traffic ticket / citation a cause of action?
I would imagine it is. Yes, sir.
It is.
I haven't really thought of it in that sense. It's certainly a commencement of a legal proceeding. So I feel as though I'm being baited, but that's fine. I'm happy to accept the bait. I'll say that I don't. That it is.
I'm not trying to.
No, I understand, sir.
But there is some case law out there, particularly on the Fever and Sepulveda. That referred to the species of property in those cases as a cause of action.
Yes, sir. But in the way it is pled here, the government hasn't pled it as a cause of action. They have pled it as a financial dollar consequence. That is the gravamen. And again, sir, we can talk about all kinds of hypotheticals. This court, and as was the district court, is obliged to consider the sufficiency of the pleading here. I mean, I could go outside the records the government did in its brief in note 15 and talk about how there was an adjudication of not guilty for all charges and so forth and so on, but that wouldn't be an appropriate consideration. The consideration here is whether the dollars, the city, the fines and costs that the government says are the financial consequence of the adjudication process is property.
Yeah, and, but if you're circumventing the adjudicative process, why isn't that enough?
Your Honor, Judge Nygaard has essentially addressed that very issue by in the Henry case some time ago, where it was a circumvention of a bidding process. So that's exactly what's happening here. There's allegation of circumvention of a process. However, the right to the property is not created until the end of the process. That is, at least in my humble view, readily apparent from the pleading. The government essentially acknowledges that in the way it pleads. It talks about a process. It talks about what happens when one is found guilty.
How do you distinguish this case from the Mariani decision that was written in the district court by Judge Van Assie?
Well, I think it's in many respects similar to the Mariani case, in that there was a process for assessment of a civil penalty. I mean, I'm counsel of record in the Mariani case, so I know it a little bit, sir. There were two components to that case. There was a part that was clear as a bell, you know, the $100 per ton penalty. But then there was a discretionary assessment process. And that is sort of where we are.
Say that part of the Mariani opinion is consistent with what you articulated.
That's exactly what we argued. That's what was argued in the brief below and is argued here. Yes, sir.
Judge Nygaard?
Judge. I have no questions.
All right. Thank you.
All right, sir.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Goldberger. It's my privilege to represent Robert Mulgrew in this appeal. But I'm speaking now for 5 minutes on behalf of all the four appellants who stood trial. Mr. Cedrone was just speaking on behalf of all six of the appellants because all of them joined in that motion to dismiss. And the motion was denied on the same grounds for everyone. But then two reserved the issue on guilty plea, and four went to trial: Tynes, Lowry, Singletary, and Mulgrew. And I want to address how and why those four defendants were prejudiced at trial by the failure to have dismissed the fraud counts. So we're on the premise that we all prevail on Mr. Cedrone's argument for the purposes of what I'm going to talk about now.
Mr. Goldberger,
yes.
The question I have is, when the jury has gone through the processes of ferreting out various counts, some of which the defendants were found guilty of, some of which were not, doesn't that undermine the prejudicial spillover argument?
That's exactly our starting point. I would pose the question just the way Your Honor did. How can they prejudice if they were acquitted of those very charges? So what happened at trial is everybody is acquitted of all the conspiracy and fraud counts and convicted of false statements and perjury counts. And this court has a four-part test for determining whether there's prejudicial spillover with respect to counts that should have been dismissed. And that's very much the posture of the case in U.S. versus Wright. I don't think there's any case that's exactly on this posture where the case went to trial and then there were acquittals. So it's counterintuitive as a starting point, I agree with you. But when you analyze it, it really comes out the same. And that is the four-point test devised in Pelullo, applied by this court in Cross, and more recently in Wright.
Let's suppose a motion to dismiss on the wire and mail fraud counts have been granted.
Yes.
And you had a trial on the false act.
Exactly the premise that I'm working on.
Okay, let's suppose that. Wouldn't they have acquit the entire background set of facts into the record in order to really understand what the case was about?
Well, certainly not all of them, and I think it's fair to say no.
Many of them?
Now we're getting somewhere in the territory. They're somewhere in the territory. Right. I will say there is not a federal district judge alive, and not Judge Stengel for sure, who would have tolerated a 25 or 28-day trial with mini trials of particular traffic tickets, with the case agent testifying over and over again as a summary witness because the case was so complex and multi-layered, with dozens and dozens of witnesses, with hundreds and hundreds of exhibits to prove whether four defendants on one, two, or a half dozen occasions, depending on which one you're talking about, made either false statements before the false declarations before the grand jury or a false statement to an FBI agent on the general, on particular questions that arise out of the general circumstances, which were the scheme, as Your Honors pointed out before. It would not have been necessary and would not have been tolerated to present a trial similar to this one. And that's at least three of the 4 points of the Bulow test go to that question. So the first question is what charges were intertwined. Well, in a way, the charges are intertwined, but when you look at the specifics of what it takes to prove perjury or false statement, Ms. Mathewson will be addressing that in detail in a moment, you can see that they are only slightly intertwined, not intertwined at the level of elements. Second, and more important, was the evidence the separate or the same? The evidence needed to prove perjury, to prove the particular false statements, was this question, was this answer to that question false beyond a reasonable doubt, would not have taken the whole proof of the scheme that the government put on for more than a month.
So your argument is that if you take the entire quantum of what the government put on, your argument isn't you should take it all away, it's that
at least 75% would be gone. Yes.
And is that part of the rule you want us to come up with, the 75% rule?
No, there's no 75% rule. It's common sense. Rule 403, because it's any substantial.
What would you have excised?
The precedent is any substantial evidence in combination with the other factors.
Okay. Let's talk. Let's chop it up.
We are getting that echo.
This is terrible, by the way. I think he has.
I can't hear you.
Was your mic muted just now?
No, my mic is not muted.
Maybe you should try to mute it because we can hear the playback.
My fault.
When you're listening to, when you're not speaking, maybe you should keep your microphone muted.
So what we allege, what we argue, is that under Rule 403, cumulative evidence, waste of time, confusion of the issues, an overwhelming amount of the evidence, a very significant body of evidence, but there is no mathematical test, would never have been admitted at a hypothetical separate perjury trial. And if I may, there's one other point, and then I'll sit down, which is...
No. Before you get to that.
Okay.
I'm really intrigued by this point because I really don't understand it. You're saying that we send it back and the district court should go through some process, sort of undefined, so that the quantum of evidence would be less. We're not sure exactly how much less, but it should be less.
No, the process is a new trial. These four defendants are entitled to a new trial on perjury counts, and they are entitled each to a separate trial because in the perjury-only case, there would be no glue under Rule 8B to permit joinder of defendants. So their trials would be entirely different. Each would be on trial for his or her own false statements, and it would be a new trial at which the judge would exercise discretion under Rule 403 to exclude waste of time, cumulative and confusing evidence of a larger scheme which was not necessary to prove the particular false statements or false declarations charged against any of them.
So in each of those separate trials, there'd have to be an individual decision by the court contextualizing the conspiracy evidence the government was going to put forth and then excising what it thought would be overage or superfluous.
There is no perjury charge at any of these hypothetical separate trials. There is no conspiracy. I'm sorry. There's no conspiracy charge. There is no conspiracy to perpetrate false declarations at the grand jury. There is no allegation.
To contextualize it, no. I mean, you wouldn't just say this is a false statement. You'd say
the government
evidence which contextualizes this.
The government would have to show that each particular statement alleged in each particular count was false, and the judge would have discretion about how much context under Rule 403 to allow to show that, and it is inconceivable that it would be in any way similar to the trial that was held.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Lisa Mathewson. I represent Thomasine Tynes. I'm speaking now for these 6 minutes on behalf of three appellants who were convicted of false declarations charges, Ms. Tynes, Mr. Mulgrew, and Mr. Lowry. For brevity, I will refer to these as perjury, although they were technically charges under 1623, false declarations before the grand jury. Your Honors, a perjury conviction fails unless there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt that both the witness understood that the witness understood the question in a way that made his answer both subjectively, knowingly false and objectively false. The premise of the government's position on both spillover and with respect to perjury is that each of these questions asked the witness, essentially, did you engage in ticket fixing? And in the government's view, because they did engage in ticket fixing, each of the questions was answered falsely. But that conglomeration of a theory is entirely impermissible in the perjury context. The principles of the Bronston case and this court's own precedent, both applying Bronston and separately from it, agree that precise questioning is an imperative for perjury, and the burden's on the questioner to pin the witness down to the specific object of the inquiry. That has two consequences.
In this context, what would be a properly posed precise question?
Your Honor, for example, there were instances where, well, let's look at the indictment, because that actually gives a great example. The indictment, if Your Honors look at appendix pages 195 and 96, paragraphs 30 and 32, attempt to define ticket fixing. That definition is noteworthy for a number of reasons. It starts with the term preferential treatment, which it then defines with reference to another term consideration, which it then defines with reference to the term ticket fixing, and then provides four defined actions, which it then circles back to connect to preferential treatment for, and this is a quote, well-connected individuals that was not available to the rest of the citizenry. As Your Honors see in the indictment, it was entirely possible for the prosecutors to formulate a specific question about particular actions. For example, find someone not guilty when they were guilty because you received a request on an index card, as the record shows that's how these requests were transmitted. The prosecutors, understandably, Your Honors, bear in mind, please, that the grand jury testimony at issue took place only weeks after the initial search. One of the prosecutors mentioned at trial that the government had not even the word consideration, for example, at the time that it questioned my client, Ms. Tynes, in the grand jury. The prosecutors were exploring a theory of mail fraud that is novel. It's invalid. They say it's valid. Whether it's valid or invalid, it was a novel theory.
Can I ask a question on this? So if a question responds, part of your theory is that there are certain terms of what essentially became terms of art that might not have been well understood. Any of the, now you're representing three clients, any of them say, I'm sorry, I don't understand?
They did not, Your Honor, but that's a very important point. There are cases in this court's jurisprudence that refer to the failure to ask for clarification, but I invite the court to examine those. That statement occurs only in cases, the U.S. versus Long case, for example, in which the term is subject to differing interpretations, but not what this court calls fundamentally ambiguous. When the question is fundamentally ambiguous, the failure to ask for clarification has no bearing under this court's jurisprudence. To hold otherwise would flip the burden to the defendant to clarify the prosecutor's questions. The prosecutor is the one that has the burden to clarify these questions. And it's important to bear in mind here precisely what we claim were the fundamentally ambiguous questions. There was a reference to favorable treatment with respect to Ms. Tynes. Did anyone ask you for favorable treatment? That term doesn't even suggest preferencing one group of litigants over another, but simply treating someone favorably in court, which is, of course, what judges are asked to do all the time. Mr. Lowry was asked, do you give special favors? Notably, Your Honors, it is highly significant that neither of those terms made their way into the indictment. And they didn't make their way into the indictment because they are meaningless. There is no way, Ms. Tynes and Mr. Lowry are both high school graduates. Don't be misled, Your Honors, by the title of judge. They are both high school graduates. In the very early stages of a confidential secret grand jury investigation, there is no way that Ms. Tynes could have had any idea what the government was getting at when they said, has anyone asked you for favorable treatment? Likewise, Mr. Lowry, when asked, do you do special favors? Moreover, not only were those...
Because favorable treatment you can draw an equal inference either way, or is that because they just didn't understand the term of art, or is it because it's just a poorly phrased question? I'm trying to...
It is not that you can draw an inference either way, Your Honor. It's that it gives no information about what action, really, the government is asking about. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is, and remember the standard from Ryan is, could this word be used with mutual understanding by questioner and witness, absent a definition or absent context? Now here, the government goes immediately to context. They concede that they never defined the term favorable treatment. When Your Honors look at the record, Your Honors will see that there was no definition before the grand jury. And likewise, they go directly to context for Mr. Lowry. They concede they never defined the term special favors. These witnesses had no notice, sitting in that grand jury weeks after the initial search, what this novel theory of mail fraud... Because, Your Honor, the way that the burden to tell the truth works is the prosecutor is obligated to pin the witness down to the precise topic of questioning. And that is from Bronston, and it occurs in myriad cases. Your Honor, what would be the truth if a judge is asked, has anyone asked you for favorable treatment? I am presently asking this court for favorable treatment, reversal and judgment of acquittal for my client. Your Honor, I'm certainly not suggesting anything untoward, but I am asking the court for a favorable disposition. And when a judge is asked, do you give favorable dispositions, do you give favorable treatment, naturally the answer to that is yes. Now, Ms. Tynes said no, but there is nothing in the record that would give her notice what this novel theory of ticket fixing was. And moreover, the trial jury had...
I hear what you're saying, but isn't that up to the jury to make that determination, and they did.
It's not, Your Honor, for this reason, and this ties to the spillover issue. The government's theory is they knew what they were doing wrong, so they knew what we were getting at.
Let's say the government's theory was they knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Leave the wrong out of it. Your clients are asked questions about what they were doing, and under oath they denied what they were doing. Like Miss Tynes was asked the question about board leaders, politicians. Has anyone called you and said Johnny Jones coming up next week? She says, throughout the years, board leaders and people have called all the time and asked me questions. Anything I will say to them is they need to go to court. Question, you never take an action on a request?
Correct.
Answer, no. I mean,
three points on that.
The jury then can conclude, based on what was presented, whether that answer no was correct or incorrect. And if it was incorrect, did it constitute a violation of the law as charged?
Your Honor, here's a crucial, Your Honor's last two words are the crucial words. That was not charged. She was not charged with answering that question falsely. In addition, and it would be a due process violation for this court to affirm on the idea that she, the way that the indictment charged that, charged count 72 falsity, is referring back to the favorable treatment. So the first question was, were you asked for favorable treatment? And the grand jury charges, her answer was false in that she was asked for favorable treatment. And then...
She said, no, not favorable treatment.
Exactly, which is also literally true, Your Honor, because there is no evidence of her having been asked for favorable treatment in those terms. Her answer, Your Honor, might appear nonsensical, given that she had just spent time talking about her adjudicative process. Of course people ask her to find them not guilty. That's what she does.
So your complaint is more about the indictment than the sufficiency of the evidence?
It's both, Your Honor. Now, there was no motion to dismiss the indictment on this basis for any of the appellants. But at this stage, the evidence was insufficient for the trial jury to determine what these witnesses had in mind when they answered the question. And speculation is prohibited. We all...
The flip side of what you're arguing, just complained about by Mr. Goldberger, in that there was 28 days of testimony.
Exactly, Your Honor. But Mr. Goldberg and I are aligned on this for exactly that reason, because the 28 days of testimony misled the jury into thinking that everybody knew what the problem was at traffic court. But when the court assesses the mental state of these appellants, the court has to look at the time of their grand jury testimony, not what they later learned about the investigation. They knew nothing. If Your Honor looks at the record on Mr. Lowry, because the government keeps talking about the consistent questioning, for example, in the grand jury, there are two points on that. One, it is simply, forgive the term, literally false as to Ms. Tynes. Your Honors will see in my briefing and my reply brief, the question came out of the blue after a question about socializing with other traffic court judges. Are you asked for favorable treatment? Second, in terms of the actual proof on that, the way that it unfolded, there was, in fact, the only thing that the trial jury heard about the grand jury testimony was certain excerpts that were read into the record, 3 pages of Ms. Tynes' testimony that essentially began almost immediately before the charge question. As to Mr. Lowry, they had 1 page of his grand jury testimony. So the government cannot rely on the context of the questioning to say they knew it, because the trial jury didn't have that information in front of it. And to turn briefly to the objective falsity question, because each appellant who has a false declarations charge also has a false, an objective falsity issue, and it is in fact the only issue for Mulgrew. As I said, as I started, perjury requires both knowing falsity and objective falsity. You can call objective falsity literal truth. Mr. Mulgrew, for example, points out that he was asked about calls. In fact, so was Ms. Tynes in the excerpt that Your Honor referenced, although she wasn't charged with that excerpt. There was no evidence about calls requesting consideration. The only evidence was about index cards. Now, it is not on the witness to say to the prosecutor, well, I know what you're getting at. And neither may the trial jury say, I know what the prosecutor was getting at, and much less may the trial juror say, I know that the witness knew what the prosecutor was getting at. Everybody thought at the end of the day, that is the jury certainly thought, that these questions were about ticket fixing. But there was nothing that gave notice to these witnesses, later defendants, now appellants, that the government was asking about this novel theory of ticket fixing.
In the grand jury, what's the... you're saying the government's obligated to make the witness know exactly what it's investigating and what's on the table. I'm not quite sure exactly what you're...
Let me take that in two pieces, Your Honor. One, of course not. What they are required to do is ask the witness precise questions that pin the witness down. This isn't my language. This is Bronston. Pin the witness down to the object of the inquiry. The object of the inquiry may be, for example, types of actions that the government eventually identified in the indictment. Did you receive an index card with a name on it and, in response to that index card, reach a more lenient outcome than the facts would have dictated? That's a very specific and easy to ask question. Now, the second point for Your Honor's consideration here is, of course, the prosecutors may have been exploring. They didn't indict this case until 18 months after they had questioned these witnesses in the grand jury. They were exploring their legal theory. And understandably, we want juries to be able to ask broad questions because we want our investigating grand juries to get all of the information. But that doesn't mean we can convict people of perjury when the questioning is imprecise. Imprecise questioning may have lots of virtues, but Bronston expressly said, and this court reiterated in Serafini 1, the 1999 Serafini, the overshadowing policy consideration is that witnesses not be deterred from testifying. If you have the suggestion that it's on the witness to clarify what the prosecutor's asking, or it's on the witness to infer what the prosecutor was asking, or as in Mr. Mulgrew's case, it's on the witness to say, well, you asked me about calls and there were no calls, but let me tell you instead about the index cards. That is 1,000% contrary not only to Bronston, but to the public policy of encouraging people to come in and testify to the grand jury.
Okay.
And if I may, I believe I have 2 minutes to talk specifically about Tynes, and I will focus here on, thank you. I will focus on things that I have not already covered. First, the ambiguity of the term favorable treatment and the fact it didn't give notice that it was asking about ticket fixing in particular. I just want to point out, Your Honor, that it actually applies to both counts because of the answer I gave earlier to Judge Fisher. Count 72 actually incorporates by reference the use of favorable treatment. It does not refer to the word leader's question that preceded it. Second, the objective falsity question. When Ms. Tynes said, no, not favorable treatment, that is a literally true statement under Bronston. And I refer the court to its Tinelli decision, where the answer to the question gave notice of the limitation that the witness was putting on it. When Ms. Tynes said not favorable treatment, it was incumbent upon the prosecutor to ask her, how do you use that term? This isn't a case like Long, where the term is a term in common usage. It is a case where favorable treatment gave no notice that they were talking about a novel theory of ticket fixing. Finally, on the objective reference to the record, which one could call a Bronston issue, literal truth, or one could simply look at as the failure of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of falsity, there is, in fact, testimony in the record that nobody gave Ms. Tynes paper because she had memory failure. The government asked her judicial assistant to explain what she did with the index cards that were incoming requests for consideration. She said she gave them to the court officer who was in the courtroom every single day, and the judicial assistant also said nobody gave Ms. Tynes paper because of her memory problem. The government never called that court officer. There is no evidence in the record that those index cards made their way to Ms. Tynes. And that is fatal both to count 71 and 72. The government cherry-picked by its own admission a few favorable, let's call them, dispositions, cases that worked out well, and by their own admission, they examined only cases in which consideration requests they believed had been made. So there's no evidence in the record from which a trial jury could infer either that a request for consideration had made its way to Ms. Tynes in any of these cases, or that she took action in response to it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So as with Ms. Tynes, I'm here to speak just for a moment about the particular insufficiency with respect to the one count, which is count 70, under which Mulgrew was charged with making a false declaration to the grand jury, the only count on which he was convicted. So again, to reiterate what Ms. Mathewson said, the defendants might well have had valid motions to dismiss these counts before trial, but they didn't make them, and under the amendments to Rule 12, that question is by the boards. So we are looking at it as a question of sufficiency of evidence. Could the jury have found beyond a reasonable doubt that answers given, and it was two questions, not even continuous to one another in the grand jury testimony, grand jury transcript, which were said to constitute a single false declaration by Mr. Mulgrew before the grand jury. The first question, both questions, let me say, were about his personal judicial assistant, referred to as personals, his judicial assistant, Ms. McNasby. The first question, had she received any calls? And the answer was, if so, she didn't convey it to me. Very simple, literal truth question, no evidence that the assistant had received any calls, that is telephone calls. And in context, calls cannot mean anything here other than telephone calls. So far as the record shows, this answer was entirely true. The second question, covered in the same count, whether McNasby ever conveyed to Mr. Mulgrew that anyone had asked her what she might do in a case to give a cited motorist special treatment. Not what the judge might do, not what she might do in what she would tell the judge, but what she could do to help a cited motorist get special treatment. And again, Mr. Mulgrew said no. And once again, there was no evidence presented that any such request for special treatment was ever made to Ms. McNasby. That's the question, and the answer is literally true. It's not the precise question I'm sure that the prosecutor wished he had asked, but it's the question that they did ask, and the answer they got cannot support a perjury conviction.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Michael Engel on behalf of Michael Lowry. The defendant's perjury in the grand jury conviction here can't be sustained simply because it was based upon a fundamentally ambiguous question that contained a fundamentally ambiguous phrase, which in this instance was, give out special favors. The question at issue from the grand jury transcript, of which only one page was presented to the jury, which gave no context to all of the questions and answers posed to my client by counsel for the government before there was a break in the action and counsel for the government, Mr. Zurek, took over the next part of the questioning. It was for the first time at that point the question about giving out special favors, whatever that term special favors might mean, came about. And the question was, I'm just asking, your testimony is you don't give out special favors, is that right? The inartful nature of the question, the fact that it's leading, the fact that it was compound, are issues that the court looks to, as well as the fact that it could have multiple meanings. The answer of no in its literal form could be no, that is not right. I do give out special favors. It could be no, I disagree with the idea that I give out special favors. Or it could be no, I never testified to anything previously in my grand jury testimony about special favors, nor was I asked about special favors. More importantly, the question with respect to special favors, what did that term mean?
Is the fact that he answered that way, that's the fault of the government for the imprecision of their question? Or is that the fault of your client for not answering and clarifying the answer?
Respectfully, as the cases submit, when there's a fundamentally ambiguous question or a phrase within that question, as we have here, the burden is on the government to ask a precise question and to follow up if there's a lack of clarity in the answer. And the specific nature in the answer itself shows, in essence, that he didn't understand what was being asked. The answer was no, and then I treat everybody in that courtroom the same, which was completely non-responsive to the question. That should lead the prosecutor to ask a follow-up clarifying question, which the prosecutor then did not do. The prosecutor then moved on to another issue, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
final point for the appellants, and if you have the tolerance for it, is unique to Mr. Mulgrew, and I'll be as brief as I possibly can. And
it's okay. The red light's going to come on. I know.
And then I'm going to sit down. This is an evidence question that applies to him only. His lawyer asked at trial for an additional question and answer from his grand jury testimony to be admitted into evidence, invoking the rule of completeness, which is Federal Rule of Evidence 106. The government objection was hearsay. That objection was sustained. So I am here to say two things. It wasn't hearsay, because went to offer another question to provide context to show what you were thinking and what you meant by something else you said. You're not offering the additional answer to the question for its truth.
Everything you say on this Rule 106 point is correct.
Yes.
Why isn't the error harmless in light of the 28 days of testimony that was out there?
Actually, the 28 days of testimony compound the showing that it's prejudicial, because Mr. Mulgrew is.
We've got to accept your other arguments.
Yes.
For purposes of this argument.
Sure. I agree. I agree. It's not harmless because this is the sole count on which he was convicted. This is the evidence which would have shown that he did not have a guilty mens rea with respect to the one count of perjury that he was alleged to have given a willfully false answer to. So it's right on the heart of the only conviction. It's favorable defense evidence going to his state of mind that, in fairness, clearly should have been allowed. So this court has yet to say specifically that hearsay is not a valid objection to a 106 offer. The court, if it reaches this issue, ought to say so clearly, because we need that in our Third Circuit jurisprudence. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Robert Zosmer on behalf of the government.
Good morning.
I'll begin, unless the court wishes otherwise, with the property issue and the sufficiency of the indictment. Mr. Cedrone is correct, we're dealing with the sufficiency of the indictment, not of the evidence at trial, though in fact the trial evidence was pretty overwhelming as to the property theory. But with the indictment, our argument really begins and ends with the allegations of the indictment. So Cedrone said to this court this morning that there's no allegation in the indictment of an attempt, a scheme to obtain property. And in fact, what it says on appendix page 197, paragraph 38 of count one, it says, in acceding to request for consideration, defendants were depriving the city of Philadelphia and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania of money which would have been properly due as fines and costs. In other words, and to some extent here, Your Honors, the parties have been speaking past each other. The argument that's consistently been made by my friends on the defense side is that unadjudicated tickets are not property in the hands of the Commonwealth. I don't dispute that as a theoretical matter. That's not what this case was about. This case was a scheme to deprive the city and state of money that was going to be owed if certain tickets were found guilty.
Is part of what your theory is that the fact that certain people were asking for consideration, scheme deprived the state and city of, or the Commonwealth and city, of property.
Our position, Your Honor, is this is an overall elaborate running scheme in an effort to reduce the amount of money that's owed by people who are connected to the judges or their personals or other court staff. That's right. But again, the important thing.
That's right. That's a very important step.
It is. But the other important step, and I think Your Honor, Judge Fischer referred to it, is what the statutes prohibit is a scheme, not success. The statutes prohibit an effort to reduce the.
That might be all well and good if it wasn't for the McNally decision that talks about the property.
Well, no, I don't agree, Your Honor. The property we're talking about here is money. Nobody can dispute that's property. And so to that extent, McNally is not applicable here. McNally is about intangible rights. This is an effort to assure that many of these people will not pay the money that they owe. Will it always be successful? No.
No, it's easier to say, it's a scheme to make sure that people pay the money that they owe, but you can't, they don't owe it until they're found guilty of violating the respective traffic law.
Correct, but they've developed this scheme with the knowledge that many, many of these people will be found guilty, and they're going through this effort in order to stop those guilty people from having to pay. Let me use as an analogy a counterfeit check case, a case that Your Honors and I have dealt with many, many times. Somebody prints up a pile of counterfeit checks, and they go to different banks, and they present them to tellers, and they try to get the money. They don't have the money until the teller falls for it and honors the counterfeit check. But the scheme is that somebody is going to fall for it. And so you may make an effort to get $1 million and you only get $500,000. Under the law, that person is guilty of a scheme to deprive these banks, whether he succeeds or not. And in fact, the sentencing guidelines would look to attempted loss and hold them accountable for the whole thing. That's what we have here. They're not doing this for fun. They are not passing these index cards and winking at each other and getting consensus to get in front of the right judges. They're not doing this day in, day out in thousands of cases just so that they can mess with the traffic court's ability to adjudicate tickets. They're doing this for a very specific reason, which is if they don't do it, which is more of their friends will owe more money unless they do this. There's no rational reason that people would go to all this effort otherwise, other than to accomplish this, to get their friends to owe less money. That is a scheme, whether it works or not, that is a scheme to deprive the city and Commonwealth of money, which is property. And again, I'll repeat, it may not work every time.
I think that you're I'm still concerned in your argument that you're putting the cart before the horse, in that you have to have a property right. You have to devise a scheme, and Mr. Cimarron said he acknowledges the scheme. You have to have a scheme to deprive, in this case, the Commonwealth and the City of Philadelphia of a property right. But they don't have that property right. They don't have that property right until someone has found the individual guilty of going 10 miles over the speed limit on Columbus Avenue.
Well, I have a couple answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, this is a scheme to deprive the city and Philadelphia prospectively of a right that will exist, which is the obligation of many of these people to pay on their tickets.
That's not what the statute in the case says. I know what you're arguing, but my question goes to the fact that the law is the law, enacted way back prior to the trilogy of Supreme Court cases, and Congress has never seen fit to change the law. And you've charged these individuals with violating the mail fraud and wire fraud statute. It talks about money and property, which I'm concerned the city and the state don't have the right to until the adjudication.
Well, the fact is the case law does support us, Your Honor. The district court cases, the Sepulveda and the other that you referred to.
You got two Northern District of Illinois cases. I recognize there's a paucity of law out here, but you have two cases there.
Well, Your Honor, Pasquantino in the Supreme Court squarely supports our position. Pasquantino is where people are smuggling liquor into Canada so that they can avoid paying taxes. Again, that tax obligation.
That's a different case. Canada was entitled to the
revenue. But not until the smuggling and the failure to disclose takes place. The other answer to Your Honor's question, which has been alluded to in the argument, is looking at this, and if you're not looking at it as an effort to gain property that you know will exist in the future, which is how I've characterized it, it's also a cause of action. Some cases refer to it as a chose action. The Second Circuit does that. No, Your Honor. Well, the traffic tickets, the district court cases have not. And Pasquantino does not. Pasquantino talks about it as a claim. That Canada will have a claim upon the illegal importation of liquor. And the Supreme Court explicitly says a claim is a species of property. So you can look at it that way. The argument I've made is that this is an effort to deprive the city and state of a property interest that the parties know will exist if they don't engage in the scheme. But you can look at it as a claim, as Pasquantino talks about, that you are aimed to defeat. And I don't see any reason there would be a distinction between criminal and civil. By the way, there's a whole industry, and I know your honors know this well, there's an industry that sells causes of action that have not been adjudicated, that may fail. There's an industry that sells debt that may not be collectible. Those are property rights. The city and state have a property right here in the claim, if not in the ultimate certainty, that many of these claims will be.
Aren't those the sales of adjudications that have been
made already? Oh, not at all. Not at all. There's a debt collection industry that sells debts that the collectors then, the purchasers then go and try and collect. And they make their payment based on their estimate of how much they're going to be able to collect.
How do you get around, not that you need to get around, but the Mariani case, the district court decision, how do you get around, how do you distinguish, using the right term, distinguish this case from Mariani?
The Mariani case and a couple others like it involve really speculative claims where, and in that, what the part of Mariani that says it's not property is the imposition of a civil penalty that is discretionary. So at the point the party's acting, it's completely discretionary as to what's going to happen. That's when you deal with the scheme here.
Why isn't that the case?
Because there is no uncertainty, and many people testify.
When you say there's no uncertainty, I just don't. You must have a spotless driving record to have never, ever had an opportunity to contest a moving violation.
Your Honor, what
there's always uncertainty.
When we assess the scheme that's charged in the indictment, we have to look at these claims globally. We can't look at individual claims here. Is there uncertainty as to any one of these traffic tickets? Absolutely. The officer might not show up. The officer might not remember. There might be a mistake on the ticket. Absolutely. But again, these defendants are not doing all this to avoid that. They're doing it because 50, 60, 70% of these tickets are fine. Globally, the property interest here is in the money that will be paid on the successful tickets. Mariani does not deal with anything like that. It deals with a couple incidents in which civil penalty is going to be discretionary. Here, we have to look at the case that was charged. And what the indictment explicitly alleges is that this was an effort, again, day in, day out, thousands of tickets, 50 examples are provided in the indictment, in an effort to reduce the amount of money that the city and state will.
So this uncertainty in the 50? Or are you making the argument that the exemplars here are, I want to use your words, one second. That you know will arise in the future?
Those 50 examples are very strong examples, and that's why they're presented, and probably all of them would have adjudicated guilty had they gone through. There are many instances that are cited there and then in the trial evidence of people who don't show up, people who are found guilty, and then they get into this system and the adjudication is reversed. Everything happens here.
Is there any estimation here? I just wonder about this. For the time period that you looked at, the government looked at, any indication of how many cases that were given favors, consideration, whatever you call them, versus the whole?
Well, I said thousands. The whole could be in the hundreds of thousands or more. But we're talking about what was the allegation of the scheme. The allegation was there was a very concentrated effort that did go on a daily basis to help the people who were connected. And again, they're not doing all this because this is a fun activity at the traffic court. They're doing this to reduce the amount of money that will be by their friends. They're doing this to deny a property interest that the city and state have, either in the claim or in the ultimate adjudication. Either way you look at it, this case involves property.
If we define property as you suggest and rule as you suggest, would that be an expansion of the notion of property in this area?
Not at all. I think that I was fascinated at the time when the pretrial motions were filed. I'm fascinated now. I think there's a very straightforward application of money as property. I don't think we're expanding the law in any way. This is a scheme, again, an effort to reduce the amount of money that will be owed by these friends to the city. Simple as that. And it's a scheme to defeat causes of action that the city has on which it will prevail in many, many of those cases. If that weren't the case, these people are all idiots to do what they did day in and day out. If all these tickets were going to be found not guilty anyway, then this whole thing is pointless. So unless there are questions on that, I will move to the other parts of the allegation. With spillover, I have little to say. There is no spillover because these counts were properly allowed to go forward. If they weren't, I disagree with my friend, Mr. Goldberger. Your Honor's pressed him on what is the evidence that would not have been admitted. He said 75% without identifying what that is. It's hard to imagine what different case would be presented. This is not the Wright case, for example. I mean, Wright, it's W-R-I-G-H-T. In the Wright case, the people are convicted of honest services fraud based on corruption. And the only count that's still standing after Skilling involves a fraud on a landlord for collecting rent, which happens to be one of the bribes, but other than that, has no other connections to the honest services fraud. Well, Skilling had been decided, and it makes it very difficult in many cases to go forward on that. There is no bribe. There was no bribe. This is a traditional fraud theory. Skilling limits honest services fraud.
So I guess that's the other part that surprises me with the scope of this investigation. The resources that the government had. There was no, as to these defendants, there was no proof of any bribe.
There wasn't. I mean, you know, Your Honor, we hear that very often. The government put in so many resources. We take criminal allegations as they come. Yeah, you know, we put in the effort we needed to, and we believe we proved our case. Jury disagreed.
I'm not criticizing the amount of resources.
Sure.
I'm just saying, based on there was no evidence of any bribes.
There was not. There was not. So this is a pretty unique case. I think Mr. Goldberg basically admitted this, where the what's left, the perjury counts, the proof is identical. The allegation of fraud is you fixed tickets. The allegation of perjury is you lied that you fixed tickets. It's hard to imagine what different case would be presented. He said there would be severance and no joinder. I'm not really sure of that at all. Joinder favors the joinder defendants charged in working with each other. Much of the evidence here would have to show that these people helped each other because that's these things were consideration requests were passed. The law does not favor severance unless the jury cannot compartmentalize the evidence. This jury had no problem compartmentalizing the fraud and the perjury counts.
What about Ms. Matheson's arguments about the imprecision of questions and the fact that they put the various defendants in positions where they were answering questions that they clearly could not have understood?
It's just, with due respect to Ms. Matheson, these questions were not fundamentally ambiguous. The question, as we know from this court's precedent, fundamentally ambiguous means just that. It is cannot be discerned by a person of ordinary intelligence. A jury is permitted to determine whether a question is ambiguous or not. It's very, very interesting that if you read through the closing arguments, as I have, word for word, these defendants never argued to this jury, to the 12 reasonable people we're counting on, that these questions were fundamentally ambiguous in any way. Now, if you're not ready to stand up in front of a jury and say nobody could understand this, it takes a bit to stand up in front of this court later and say that. But the most interesting thing, I'll just talk about Lowry for a minute, because I think you do have to go through these questions individually to answer the allegations that are made. But the Lowry thing, and I'll be frank, I noticed this last night. I'd sort of run out of things to do to get ready, and I was reading through the appendix, and this just stopped me in my tracks, which is in Mr. Lowry's opening statement to the jury. This was by Mr. DiStefano, who was representing him at trial. On page 682 of the appendix. So remember, Lowry is asked, did he give special favors? And he says no. And what we're being told now is that's ambiguous. Can't understand what that means. Now, if you read the grand jury transcript, that can't be sustained because he's asked for 60 pages about this tip-fixing scheme. And so, of course, he knows what it's about. But what's really amazing is page 682 of the appendix in the opening statement. This is what Mr. DiStefano says to the jury. And in a nutshell, members of the jury, the evidence is going to show that Mike Lowry didn't give out any special favors, didn't fix any tickets, but rather treated everybody in the courtroom, whether he be a working man or a woman who didn't know anybody or somebody who knew somebody, in exactly the same manner, even-handedly, thoughtfully, and with due consideration. So here you have his lawyer arguing the same term to the jury that they say a person of reasonable understanding can't understand. This is not much of an argument, is what this comes down to. Everybody in the grand jury, I'm sure, and certainly at trial, understood, as did Mr. Lowry, when he's asked, I'm just asking, your testimony is you don't give out special favors, is that right? Answer, no, I treat everybody in that courtroom the same. And this is surrounded by pages of evidence, of questioning about the how this works with the personals and consideration and all that. Now, Mr. Engel does point out that this wasn't all read to the jury. However, the grand jury transcripts were introduced in evidence. They're marked as exhibits. A stipulation was read that they're accurate, and then they were introduced and available to the jury. So the term was not ambiguous. You have to look at the full context here. The district court decidedly rejected this argument after trial. It said the terms the prosecutors used were simple, direct, and capable of being understood by anyone with a basic working knowledge of the English language. That's at page 33 and 34 of the appendix. And I don't believe there's a basis here to dispute what Judge Stengel concluded. And then finally, he didn't mention it this morning, but Mr. Lowry argues that he believed his answers to be true, that he thought he wasn't giving favorable treatment. And to do that, he dismisses the testimony of O'Donnell, his personal, Smaslow, his court officer, says it was too ambiguous. And for that, the district court said on page 36, Mr. Lowry's argument borders on frivolous. There was overwhelming evidence that he took action to help people. So, again, special favors is not fundamentally ambiguous by any stretch in the context of this case.
The term they talked about was favorable treatment.
So we'll get to Ms. Tynes. Let me do that, and then I'll come back to Mr. Mulgrew. With regard to Ms. Tynes, again, if you look at the grand jury testimony, it's obvious what we're talking about. Ms. Mazathan said something this morning I thought was interesting. She said, it's been a few weeks since the traffic court was searched. And I stopped and thought, my gosh, can you imagine if you're running a judicial institution and federal agents swoop in to search the building, are the people in that court going to talk about anything else for those, quote, few weeks that follow an incident like that? But she's saying, oh, Ms. Tynes just comes in blatantly unaware of what's going on here after engaging in this effort with others for years as part of this consideration effort and doesn't know what she means by favorable treatment. And if you have any doubt, you just read her answer. People know me. The lawyers know me. The court officers know me. I'm a no-nonsense person. I let the cards fall where they may. She knows exactly what she's being asked. And again, you can read the rest of the grand jury testimony and see that. They say you never take an action on a request after asking her about ward leaders, politicians, calling. It's very clear what's being asked here. In the briefs, and Ms. Mastin didn't mention it today, in the briefs, they had a different argument. It was, oh, she must have thought they were asking about a bribe. When they ask favorable treatment or they ask about a request, must have been asking about a bribe. Though no one's ever alleged any bribe here, and it's not in the tenor of the questions and answers at all. So, no, we do not agree with that position with regard to any of this being fundamentally ambiguous. Finally, Ms. Matthews.
There's never any evidence of bribery or any exchange for money?
No. No. I mean, obviously, in the general sense, much of this is for political benefit because you're doing this with politicians and world leaders and these people have to get elected. But Skilling has left us in a difficult spot with regard to that. But here you happen to have a clear fraudulent scheme that violates the mail and wire fraud laws. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, she highlights, as she does in her brief, evidence that this claim that Judge Tynes really didn't understand anything. She was entering her dotage, I suppose they're saying, and she was losing it and she wasn't understanding it. That's up to the jury. You can read her grand jury testimony and see she's a very smart woman who speaks very articulately and answered all the questions in the grand jury. There was lots of evidence, including from her personal. Now, it's true. There are pieces of the evidence, as in any trial, that the defense could rely on, but the government could rely on the fact that her personal, Ms. Warren, said she actually talked to Judge Tynes about this consideration scheme, as well as handing cards to her court officer that went into the courtroom. And you can look at the results, which is there are numerous people we showed at trial, numerous people who either didn't show up and their tickets were dismissed in Judge Tynes' courtroom, or they showed up and one recounted, I think two actually recounted, that they sat there and they were the last people in the courtroom and said, hi, I'm here. And Judge Tynes says, oh, no, your case has been dismissed without the person saying a word. So obviously sufficient evidence on which the jury could rely. And then finally, with regard to Mr. Mulgrew, So with Mr. Mogru, again, it's important to look at the questions in counts 70 and 71. They are not arguing here that the questions were ambiguous in any way. The only argument with regard to Mogru is literal truth. And the only argument that's being offered with regard to Mogru is being offered here for the first time. We submit that this should be on plain error review. Because in the district court, it was different. In the district court, they argued inconsistency of the verdict, and they argued materiality of the answers. None of this this business about literal truth. An examination of the new argument fails in any event. What he's first asked is, how about your personal? Has your personal received any calls like this? And so the argument is, okay, it's literally true. She didn't get any phone calls. Now, if that's where the charge stopped, that would be an interesting issue, because it's not clear that it only relates to calls. It's referring back, it says, did you receive any calls like that? And what the previous question refers to is, have other judges approached you or called you, either themselves or through their personal? So we could have a debate over what calls means. But apparently the prosecutor, either Ms. Wolf or Mr. Zork, I don't remember which it was in the grand jury at this moment, realized, I've got to pin this a little bit more after he said calls. And so the other part of this count is the next part of the question. Let me make sure that I got your testimony correct. You're saying that if other people, whether they be political leaders, friends and family, anybody's approaching your personal and asking her specifically to look out for a case, see what she can do in a case, give preferential treatment, however you want to phrase it, that she's not relaying any of that information onto you, is that correct? And he says, no, she isn't. And so the literal truth argument now is that it focuses on this preferential treatment and says Ms. McNasby, who's the personal that we're talking about here, cannot give preferential treatment. She, not a judge, she can't adjudicate the ticket. And therefore, it's a literally true answer. That, to borrow Judge Stengel's phrase, that borders on frivolous, because of course she's taking action. Of course she's doing preferential treatment. She's taking this index card that says, find this guy not guilty, and handing it to the judge, which is something she should not be doing in the ordinary course of her employment. He knows that there was an avalanche of evidence of Mr. Mogru taking these requests, making requests to others. And so it's a literally false answer, even if you limit it, even if you think this question is only about Ms. McNasby. And that answers that question. And again, it's quite striking, and this, again, is true for Lowry and Tynes as well. None of this is argued to the jury. You can't stand in front of a jury and say, oh, they just meant phone calls, or, oh, the must have been talking about just the personal. I think that says a lot about the merit of the claim here. The final claim that I have not addressed is Mr. Mulgrew's claim about the rule of completeness and whether this earlier question had been offered. Now, it's true, the judge did not permit this to be read to the jury at trial, but then admitted the whole grand jury transcript. But putting that aside, it's very important to look at the actual question and answer there. So
if I understand you correctly, your point is the argument could have been made in summation because the transcript was available.
It could have, absolutely. And in fact, really the same, I'll go to the question in a moment. The argument was made to the jury over and over again. The real defense here by all of the defendants had nothing to do with whether they understood questions or literal truth. The defense, and perhaps it worked because the jury acquitted on the conspiracy charges, the defense over and over was, we didn't give any preferential treatment to anybody. The ticket fixing didn't happen. Everybody got a fair shake. Tons of people walk out with favorable adjudications. That was the defense. That's what the case was about. And that's what they argued over and over. And that's what it says in this question and answer that they say jury have to hear. And the question and answer is whether you've been ever asked to provide what I'll call favorable treatment for people in traffic court, however you define it, whether it be special handling, keep an eye out for a ticket, do me a favor. Have you ever been asked to provide any type of treatment like that for people in traffic court? And the answer was, people have asked me for consideration, but I give consideration to everybody that comes in my courtroom, so it doesn't make a difference to me.
So what impact, if any, is there from the fact that the jury bought that argument?
I don't think there's any impact in terms of the question of evidentiary admissibility as to the perjury count. I can't go that far. But what I can say is, if you read all of Mulgrew's testimony, including that, he's asked every which way about whether he gave favorable treatment. He denies it every which way, using all the different terms. It happens that the government charged the later passage. There's nothing here that's inconsistent with it. They say, oh, well, it shows his understanding of the word consideration. But in the charged count, That's not the question he was asked. And again, remember, he doesn't argue that the questions that are charged are ambiguous in any way. He's asked, did anybody come to you and try to get tickets fixed, is what he's asked. So his understanding of the word consideration doesn't mean anything. I look at this now, and I'll never question my colleagues, who may be better trial lawyers than I am, but I look at this question, and I think the government should read this question to the jury. It's all part of this continuing effort by Mr. Mulgrew throughout his testimony to deny in whatever way. He brings up the word consideration himself, which is the term that many people use, because he's there to deny any involvement. Well, he doesn't, but
same way, right?
Well, right, but why does he mention that word? And that's not the question that's asked, because he knows what he's there for. He knows what he's there to deny. We wait until he gives a very specific false answer. That's what's charged in count 70. That's what he's guilty of.
Were there any redactions from the submission of the grand jury to the of the grand jury transcript to the jury?
No, not that I'm aware of. I will double check that, because I don't want to give an incorrect answer. But if you don't hear from me, the answer is very clearly no. They were admitted in their entirety. They're in the appendix in their entirety. And you'll see, in fact, I think I have a citation for it where they're admitted. Your testimony begins on page 416 of the appendix. The stipulation regarding their accuracy is 5932. And then all the marked exhibits are admitted at 5935. Thank you very much, Ron.
Well, how are we doing it? How are we splitting this up?
It's all me, Your Honor.
It's all you. Okay. I'm so sorry. One second. Judge Nygaard, did you have anything for Mr. Zalmer?
No, thank you. I'm fine.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. The court's permission, I'll go back to the property topic. Saying that these tickets were property because they may in the future be adjudicated is like saying that an indictment is property because it may in the future result in the award of restitution.
Well, I think what he was saying, I'd like you to comment on this. I think what he was saying was that it's the scheme to deprive, and so why isn't that proper?
2 points on that, Your Honor. First, the statute in fact refers to a scheme to obtain. We all tend to use the phrase scheme to deprive, but it is not in fact a scheme to deprive. It is a scheme to obtain property that is in the hand of the victim. The bank, for example, that is victimized by a counterfeit check has the money in the vault. And a scheme to deprive the bank of that money is a scheme to obtain property. The problem here is one of timing. A scheme to deprive the Commonwealth of something that may eventually become property may be honest services fraud, as Judge Fisher points out. And yet, if it were an honest services fraud, it would need the link to something tangible, something of value. And as we know, there was nothing of value exchanged here. There was no bribery. So the government's honest services fraud theory didn't work. But what it has ended up with is a completely intangible crime, because it is a scheme, in theory, to deprive the Commonwealth and the city of potential property. But that is not cognizable under the mail fraud statute. Moreover, the defendants would not have knowledge at the time of the scheme that any given ticket would result in a given outcome. Bear in mind, Your Honors, that although we think about traffic tickets as something that just in the government says, well, when you're found guilty, you pay the fine, there's no discretion, the problem is we have to back up a step. These are tickets that they do not allege, they cannot allege, would necessarily have been adjudicated guilty and resulted in the payment of a fine. Again, it's like saying that an indictment gives the government a property interest in restitution. The tickets are accusations, Your Honors. And
one concern I have is how do you distinguish this from Pasquantino?
Pasquantino is actually in the defense's favor on this, because in Pasquantino, the tax accrued only upon the occurrence of a specified event. That is the import. Here, the tax became property upon the importation. It is not that the goods sitting in the United States represented potential tax revenue to Canada. They're imported, taxes due. Here, the government is suggesting if the government were indicting Pasquantino on this theory, they'd be saying that diverting goods in the United States and preventing them from crossing into Canada was cheating Canada out of revenue. And it is absolutely crucial that, again, the court looks at the indictment. Mr. Zosmer just said in the perjury context, well, it just happens that, you know, the prosecutors indicted a certain statement. That's not how the court treats indictments, of course. It would be a due process violation.
Actually, if you want to analogize the Pasquantino, wouldn't you say that Mr. Zosmer would argue that it was a scheme to deprive Canada of taxes, and that would be the analogy?
Yes, but on the government's theory here, it would be deprive Canada of the potential taxes before the goods cross the border. In Pasquantino, the tax was due because the goods were there. Something had happened that created a property right Canada held. Here, the thing that created the property right did not occur. And again, with careful attention to the indictment, we cannot forget that there's...
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I keep focusing on Pasquantino. So in Pasquantino, you're saying that the crime could not be analogous because it over the border, it's completed. So let's say it didn't. They wouldn't be able to charge the crime?
They wouldn't be able to charge a property fraud, Your Honor. Maybe there'd be some other crime they could charge, just as had they found bribery here, which they didn't, they could have charged an honest services fraud. The point is there has to be some nexus to property, or else we end up with these completely intangible offenses that are equivalent to saying a court's entitled to restitution, you know, as soon as the indictment is brought.
It sounded like a great wrap-up.
Well, it perjury, Your Honor, with the court's permission, just briefly, we will get back to the court on the question of the record, because my firm understanding is that portions of the transcripts were actually introduced into evidence. The complete transcripts were not introduced into evidence.
You don't need to write us on whether they're complete. Actually, I can't speak for my colleagues. I'm only concerned with the excerpt that Mr. Zosmer was referencing at that particular point in time, because it obviously undercuts the argument if what Mr. Goldberger was referencing is in the transcript.
So, I'm sorry, portion with respect to trial counsel's argument?
As I understood Mr. Zosmer's argument, and he was referencing the fact that the transcript was in evidence as it relates to Mr. Goldberger's 106 reference. And if the grand jury transcript with regard to that argument is in, then that obviously undercuts the argument.
Absolutely true. I believe it is not, and that's the topic on which we'll get back to the court. Importantly, Mr. Zosmer said things like, everyone understood at trial what was going on here. This points to the spillover problem. In fact, Mr. Zosmer is making our argument on spillover right now when he says trial counsel didn't raise these question-by-question issues about the perjury counts. Trial counsel couldn't, because even though Braunston requires, as Mr. Zosmer admits, a question-by-question analysis, it was impossible, given this conglomeration of evidence and the government's consistent theme that we asked about ticket fixing and they denied it. It was impossible for trial counsel to do anything other than attack the ticket fixing scheme in the first instance. That proves the spillover prejudice from the inclusion of these invalid counts. Fundamentally, Your Honor, the government is asking the court to require grand jury witnesses to read the minds of prosecutors who are exploring a novel theory of mail fraud. Doing that, Your Honor, would not only violate due process for our clients, it would impair the public interest in encouraging people to come testify in the grand jury.
Judge Nygaard, do you have anything else?
No questions. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.